type 2 diabetes reversible? Is sugar harmful? Does sugar have different names? Is obesity a disease? What is fasting? How safe is the keto diet? This series of The Medicine Box talks to health and nutrition experts to break down answers to these very questions and more so that you can aim to be your healthiest best. Hello and welcome to The Medicine Box on CNBCTV18.com with me, your host, Ekta Batra. This podcast aims to give you an insight on all things pharma and health, from discussing trends in the industry to key issues in health with all the relevant experts. And this series of The Medicine Box is focused on health, nutrition, and wellness. Our guest on today's podcast is Dr. Robert Lustig. He is a professor emeritus of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California. He holds degrees from MIT, Cornell University, and UC Hastings College of Law. Dr. Lustig is one of the most popular voices globally on the detrimental impact of sugar on health. His lecture, Sugar, the Bitter Truth, went viral in 2009 and currently has close to 8 million views on YouTube. He is the author of New York Times bestseller book, Fat Chance, and his latest book, The Hacking of the American Mind. Dr. Lustig, hi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Ms. Batra. Thank you.
So, Dr. Lustig, let's start the conversation by you telling us a little bit about your background. What is it that you actually do, and what is your key philosophy?
Well, I'm a pediatric endocrinologist, which means I take care of hormone disorders in children, all different kinds, diabetes being a common one, and of course obesity, and obesity has become a worldwide problem, which doesn't seem to be getting any better, only seems to be getting worse. I started doing research on obesity about 20 years ago when I was at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis. And by studying kids who became obese after their therapy for brain tumors, we determined that the cause of their obesity had nothing to do with their food intake or with their exercise. What it had to do with was changes in their brain biochemistry. And when we started looking at children who did not have brain tumors, but just standard garden variety obesity, we found the same phenomenon. So what we came to realize was that the behaviors that one associates with obesity, the increased food intake, the decreased energy expenditure, the gluttony and the sloth that, of course, all obese people are accused of, was actually a result of the biochemical problem rather than the cause. And one thing I can tell you for sure, after 40 years as a physician, if you don't know what the cause of a problem is, you can't treat it. So by directing our efforts at the biochemistry, we have made enormous inroads in being able to deal with obesity. Now the question is, of course, well, what is causing this brain problem in people that don't have brain tumors? And that research has led us to sugar. Sugar being, you know, empty calories, according to the industry, but in fact, we have learned much more about the dangers of sugar, having to do with three different pathways. One, causing fatty liver, which is now a worldwide epidemic. Two, the aging process, which causes cell damage and causes a lot of the phenomena you know about, like heart attacks and stroke and hypertension. And finally, the fact that sugar activates the reward system of the brain in the same way alcohol does. And in fact, sugar is addictive. You put those three things together and you have a worldwide disaster that is bankrupting countries around the world in terms of both their healthcare and in terms of their general budget. We're trying to fix it.
Okay. Dr. Lustig, is sugar the only primary cause of this?
I can't tell you it's the only, but it is certainly a primary cause, if not the primary cause. It is the one that has gone up the most around the world, and it is the one that is easiest to fix if we chose to fix it. Because sugar is added to foods, added sugar. The fact is, we could stop adding sugar to foods. Now, the food industry would make less money, but in fact, we would save a lot more, and we'd all have increased economic productivity, decreased healthcare costs, and the food industry would still make money. That's part of the issue, is how to refine the business model so that the food industry continues to make money while doing the right thing instead of the wrong thing.
Can you describe to us what exactly sugar is and what does it do to your body?
Certainly. So, dietary sugar, and it's got many names, sucrose, or corn, which is table sugar, high fructose corn syrup, agave, honey, maple syrup. In India, you have jaggery, and it has many other names around the world. In fact, it actually started in India as brown liquid kanda, which, you know, gave us our word candy back in 1200 BC. It is composed of two molecules that are either joined together or free. Those two molecules, one is called glucose, one is called fructose. Now, glucose is the energy of life. Every cell on the planet burns glucose for energy. Glucose is so important that if you don't consume it, your body makes it. The Inuit, the Eskimos, they didn't have any place to grow a carbohydrate. They had whale blubber. They still had a serum glucose level. And the reason was because their livers were adept at taking the fats and turning them into glucose. So glucose is so important that if you don't consume it, your body will make it. Fructose, on the other hand, that's the sweet molecule in sugar. That's the molecule that goes to the reward center and causes addiction. And it's also the molecule that goes to the liver and gets turned into liver fat. So that molecule we don't need. There's no biochemical reaction in any vertebrate or any eukaryote, any animal cell on the planet that needs dietary fructose. It is completely vestigial from animal life. Plants used it as a storage form of energy. It's one of the things that separated plants from animals evolutionarily. It is completely unnecessary. It is, in fact, only an energy source. It is not nutrition because it's not required. And when consumed in excess, it drives liver fat accumulation, which drives this phenomenon called insulin resistance. Your liver gets sick, and therefore you get sick and you gain weight. And we also know it causes the aging reaction. Ladies, it's the cause of wrinkles. And finally, it's addictive. So you put those things together, and fructose, this molecule that is inseparable from dietary sugar because it's the sweet molecule, is what's driving all of this chronic metabolic disease around the world, including India.
Okay.
So much so that the Indian government petitioned Pepsi-Cola several years ago to take the added sugar out of Pepsi-Cola, asked Indra Nooyi, who's from, you know, Madras, India, from Catholic University in Madras, India. She was trying to help her own population, asked them to reduce the amount of added sugar in Pepsi to try to stave off obesity and diabetes in the Indian population.
Okay, yes, absolutely. That point is taken, Dr. Lustig. In fact, India is is slowly becoming the diabetes capital of the world. But what is...
Have more people. So you're going to have more diabetes.
So tell us, what exactly is fructose found in? Which are the foods that that contain fructose that we need to be aware of?
Right. So fructose is the sweet molecule that makes sugar palatable. It's the molecule we crave. It's the molecule we seek. It is, of course, found in fruit. So people say, well, but fruit's not bad. Fruit's fine. And indeed, fruit is fine. And the reason fruit is fine is because it comes with an enormous amount of fiber. Now, when you consume sugar in its inherent form, with its fiber, so we call that whole fruit. If it, you know, I mean, it could be an apple or an orange or, you know, really any other whole fruit. the soluble and insoluble fiber that's found in that fruit. So the soluble fiber is like pectins, like what holds jelly together. The insoluble fiber is like cellulose, like the stringy stuff in celery. Whole fruit has both. When you consume whole fruit, you're getting the soluble fiber, the insoluble fiber, and a dose of sugar. That fiber makes a gel. It actually coats the inside of your intestine and forms a secondary barrier that prevents early absorption. Therefore, that sugar is not headed to the liver. Therefore, that fructose is not going to get turned into liver fat. And therefore, you're not going to get sick, and it's going to keep you healthy, and it's going to keep your blood insulin levels down because you didn't absorb it. So what happens to it if you don't absorb it early? It moves further down the intestine. And what's in the later intestine that's not in the early intestine? The bacteria, the microbiome, all the bacteria. Now, you have 10 trillion cells in your body, but you have 100 trillion bacteria in your intestine. Mm-hmm. Your bacteria outnumber you 10 to 1. You are just a big bag of bacteria with legs. Mm. Now, those bacteria have to eat something. Well, what do they eat? Well, they eat what you eat. The question is, how much did you get versus how much did they get? If you ate your fruit, whole fruit, yes, you ate sugar, but you ate way more fiber. That delivers that sugar that didn't get absorbed further down the intestine so that the bacteria could chew it up for their own purposes. And you increase microbial diversity, you keep your bacteria healthy, and you keep them from causing metabolic disease. So by delaying absorption, the fiber in fruit prevents the sugar in fruit from being a problem.
But what about the bad fruit?
Well, so that means everything else that's in the grocery store, because sugar's been added to 74% of all the items in the American grocery store, specifically because the food industry figured out if they add it, you buy more. So it's obviously in things like soda. It's obviously in things like fruit juice, not added, but as soon as you take the fiber away, it might as well be added. It's in cakes and cookies and pastries, you know, dessert, things that we would identify as dessert. But here in America, 49%, almost half of the added sugar that we consume are in foods we didn't even know had it, like yogurt, salad dressing, barbecue sauce, ketchup, hamburger buns, hamburger meat.
Oh.
And the list goes on. Basically, if the food has a label, it's a warning label, because virtually every food that has a label has added sugar. I'll give you an example. I don't know if you have it in India, but we certainly have it here in the United States. It's a cereal called Raisin Bran.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have it in India?
No, we don't, but we have a lot more cereals which are now coming into the market.
Well, most of them are very high in sugar. In America, half of the cereals have greater than 40% of their calories as added sugar, which is enormous. And some of them are as high as 56%. So basically, it's dessert. Mm-hmm. And I wrote an op-ed in The Guardian last year called "Sugar is the Alcohol of the Child." So why do we let it dominate the breakfast table? Mm. In fact, the way fructose is metabolized in the liver, causing that liver fat accumulation, is exactly the way alcohol is metabolized in the liver. And it also causes liver fat accumulation. That's why alcoholics get cirrhosis. Well, guess what? Children now get cirrhosis from fatty liver disease the same way. So basically, sugar is the alcohol of the child.
And this would be available in all processed food, which is, say, for example, in a packet.
That's correct. So if it has a label, you need to check to see whether or not sugar is one of the first five ingredients.
Okay. And sugar has different names as well, right?
Absolutely. There are, by my count, 56 different names for sugar. We actually wrote an ebook called "Sugar Has 56 Names, A Shopper's Guide." And they are allowed to put different kinds of sugar in the food, and it will appear lower on the ingredients list But when you add it up, it could actually be number one. So things like Demerara, things like Pinocha, things like evaporated cane juice, these are all just sugar. Mm. But they use different names to disguise it so that it's hiding in plain sight.
Okay. What about other forms of sugar? For example, jaggery that you mentioned is very, very highly and widely used in India, along with something like honey, which is used as a sugar substitute and considered healthy. So is it healthy?
No. Basically, calorie for calorie, gram for gram, ounce for ounce, all dietary sugars are the same. There's molasses, which is not very sweet, which is basically just glucose. There's agave, which is mostly fructose. There's maple syrup, there's honey. Jaggery is basically just an unrefined form of sugar that's popular in India. But it is exactly the same in terms of its caloric value and also its detrimental effects on the liver and on the body.
Is it okay, however, to eat some amount of sugar? How much of sugar consumption is bad? How much of sugar consumption is good? And how often should you eat it or not eat it?
Right. So if it comes as a piece of fruit, it's not a problem, because basically if it came with its fiber, that sugar wasn't for you, it was for your bacteria. So I don't think fruit is the problem. On the other hand, if you squeeze it and you strain out the fiber, now that fruit juice might as well be a soda. Now, American Heart Association in 2009 suggested an upper limit of 6 teaspoons of added sugar per day for women and 9 teaspoons of added sugar per day for men. And I was actually a co-author of that paper. Since then, the Scientific Advisory Committee on Nutrition, SACEN, in the UK had actually suggested an upper limit of 5% rather than 7 to 8%. So they suggested going down to 6 teaspoons of added sugar per day. Since then, the food industry lobbied the WHO and the USDA heavily, and so they ended up compromising at 10% of calories, which would be 12 teaspoons of added sugar per day. Now, I'll be honest with you, 12 teaspoons of added sugar per day is too much, but it is what the WHO and the USDA compromised on. Mm. However, considering our current consumption of added sugar is 20 teaspoons per day, getting down to 12 would be a pretty good feat. Mm. And I would love to see that.
So what about salt and fat, Dr. Lustig? Would you apply the same kind of detrimental effects of salt and fat as we do to sugar, as well as carbohydrates? There are lots of myths out there.
Right. Certainly, there are a lot of myths. I won't argue that. Certainly, salt is not great for you. We currently consume triple our need for salt. We need 2.3 grams per day. We consume 6.9 grams per day. So we are consuming triple the amount we need. Now, the good news about salt is that 80% of the American population, I'm not sure if this is true in India, but 80% of the American population can lose that extra salt from their kidneys with essentially no detrimental side effects. On the other hand, 20% are going to have salt-sensitive hypertension, increase their blood pressure, and end up having a heart attack or stroke because of the excess salt. The excess salt is certainly not needed. It was put there by the food industry in part as a preservative and also in part because it increases palatability. However, the UK actually reduced consumption of added salt across the board from 2006 to 2012 and saw a 30 to 40% reduction in the incidence of stroke and hypertension. So there's no question that getting salt down will improve public health. Now, fat is a complicated story because fat is not just one kind of fat. In fact, there are several kinds of fats. The easy way to divide them up would be animal fat and dairy fat. Turns out dairy fat is very different from animal fat. dairy fat, so what's found in milk and cheese, turns out to be odd chain fatty acids with a specific phospholipid signature that appears to be protective against heart disease and diabetes, as opposed to animal fat, which gets a little complicated, but may have a slight increase in risk for heart disease and diabetes. The problem is animal fat usually comes along with animal muscle, which has a lot of iron and also a lot of choline, which have their own detrimental effects. Okay. So it's hard to separate the fat from the other phenomena that are going on in red meat.
Okay.
But in general, fat is not the problem that it was made out to be. Sugar, on the other hand, is a major problem. Refined carbohydrate, so wheat, corn, potatoes, pasta, rice, that is glucose, and glucose means insulin, and insulin means weight gain. Mm. So it is definitely part of the obesity equation.
Okay.
But fructose is specific in terms of the liver fat accumulation and the aging reaction.
So you've, in fact, called type 2 diabetes a processed food disease. So according
yes,
to
I
you, do you think that it is reversible if in case it's caught in the early stages?
Absolutely. We have the data. It's been done by several groups, and actually there's now a company in the United States called Virta Health that is packaging a ketogenic diet as a reversal for type 2 diabetes. And people who are on their diet for 1 year, 80% of them have come off their insulin medications and have become euglycemic and have no signs of diabetes whatsoever. So this notion that diabetes is a long-term chronic debilitating disease that cannot be prevented or reversed, just treated with medication, is a farce. It's garbage. It's a mistake. And to be honest with you, it's being perpetrated by a lot of pharma companies that have a lot of money to be made by peddling this mumbo jumbo. If you get to type 2 diabetes early, and when I say early, certainly within the first 3 years and really probably within the first 7 years of its onset, there's a very good chance that if you changed your diet, you could reverse it. You could prevent it, you could reverse it, and you could come off your medications. And this is extraordinarily important, especially in the developing world where, you know, healthcare budgets don't have the money for the refrigerators to house the insulin, never mind the insulin itself.
Absolutely. That point is completely taken, Dr. Lustig. So what is an ideal diet? One to even prevent diabetes or even to reverse it? Or does one need to go down the ketogenic diet way? Or can we just do it with normal food and cutting out sugar?
That's a very good question, and it depends on who you are. It depends on what your insulin reserve is. It depends on your genetics. It depends on your weight. It depends on your sex. It depends on your age. So there's no one prescription for that. Some people are so severe that they will need a ketogenic diet in order to be able to reverse the process. Some people can probably do it on just a very low carbohydrate diet. Some people can do it on just real food, getting rid of the refined carbohydrate and sugar. In fact, most people probably fall into that category. The one thing I'm sure of is that if you continue to eat processed food, you will not get better. You will only get worse, and you will only need more medication, and you will die younger. That I'm very sure of.
Dr. Lustig, then leave us with a synopsis of your latest book, The Hacking of the American Mind, where you're talking about how companies are in fact influencing our choices on a daily basis.
Indeed. So we've certainly talked about our healthcare crisis. We are also suffering a Social Security crisis, an addiction crisis, and a depression crisis in our country. I maintain in the book that these four crises are actually really four manifestations of a single crisis. There are four different results of one problem, and that problem is our current inability to distinguish two positive emotions, pleasure and happiness. Pleasure and happiness are not the same. So what are the differences? I count seven. Pleasure is short-term, happiness is long-term. Pleasure is visceral. You feel it in your body. Happiness is ethereal. You feel it above the neck. Pleasure is taking. Happiness is giving. Pleasure is experienced alone. Happiness is usually experienced in social groups. Pleasure can be achieved with substances. Happiness cannot be achieved with substances. The extremes of pleasure, whether it be substances or behaviors, substances like cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, sugar, or behaviors, shopping, gambling, video gaming, social media, pornography. In the extreme, all lead to addiction. There's an aholic after every one of those. Shopaholic, sexaholic, alcoholic, chocoholic, etc. But there's no such thing as being addicted to too much happiness. And finally, number 7, pleasure is dopamine, happiness is serotonin. Mm-hmm. So two different areas of the brain, two different neurotransmitters, two different sets of receptors, two different regulatory pathways, two different mechanisms of action. These are not the same.
Okay.
Well, why do we care? Why do we care? The reason is because dopamine kills neurons. Serotonin doesn't. Mm. So when dopamine kills neurons, what happens is you need more and more to get less and less. That's a phenomenon called tolerance, and that leads to addiction. Serotonin does not. The problem is, if you don't know the difference between pleasure and happiness, companies can sell you stuff that they will tell you will provide happiness. And really what it's providing is pleasure. And problem is, the more pleasure you seek, the more unhappy you get. And so addiction and depression are two sides of the same coin, and they're affecting the entire developing and developed world.
So, Dr. Lustig, are people allowed to eat a small piece of chocolate every day or not?
When you say small, how small are we talking?
What I mean to say is, how much is good, how much is bad? Tell us.
Right. So, certainly a small piece of dark chocolate, if that is your reward, and that's your only reward, that's fine. I would venture to guess that people who need a small piece of dark chocolate every day as their reward are probably getting other rewards during the day as well. Basically, sugar is good once a week, not once a meal. And right now, at 20 teaspoons per day of added sugar, we're getting it morning, noon, and night, breakfast, lunch, supper, snacks, midnight. We are awash in the stuff, and it is killing us.
And what about artificial sweeteners? Does it apply to that as well?
Well, artificial sweeteners are complicated. We don't have the final answer on them, so I can't be definitive. What I can say is that early data suggests that artificial sweeteners are not good for you. We don't have the level of data that we have for sugar yet. We have acute data, we don't have chronic data. We have pharmacokinetics, we don't have pharmacodynamics. So, you know, the jury is still out on artificial sweeteners, but based on what we do know today, it does not look like artificial sweeteners solve the problem.
Okay. All right, Dr. Lustig, thank you very much for taking the time out and speaking with us on your thesis with regards to what you think the detrimental impact of sugar is. Thank you very much for joining in.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bartram. My pleasure.